This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says termination of the Saudi-led coalition siege of Yemen is necessary for the continuation of the existing truce. Hundreds of Google and Amazon employees are halt or to hold a protest calling for the cancellation of their company's multi-million dollar deal with Israel. And at least 10 people are killed in a stabbing spree in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan. Police say the two suspects are still at large. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. Iran's foreign minister says the current truce holding in Yemen wholly depends on the Saudi-led coalition ending its siege of the impoverished country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg. He said Yemen's stability and security has a direct impact on the stability and security of the entire region, including the Persian Gulf. Amir Abdullahian pointed out that the final decision makers on the future of Yemen are the people of that country. The UN-sponsored truce in Yemen came into effect in April and was renewed in June. It's been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war and has endured despite multiple violations from the Saudi side. Yemen's oil ministry has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to shed light on the looting of Yemeni crude oil by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. It says Riyadh and its allies continue to block Yemeni fuel ships and steal the country's oil despite a UN-brokered truce. More in this report by Abdullatif Al-Washali.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila. At a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crunch due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of staff working for American tech giants Google and Amazon are going to stage vigils outside the headquarters of the two firms in protest at a controversial deal with Israel. The vigils are set to be held on September 8th. in the cities of San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. The employees' protests are part of a movement known as No Tech for Apartheid, and want to prevent Israel from using technology in its crimes against the Palestinians. The movement, which was founded last year, has started a campaign to sign a petition against a deal worth over $1 billion. So far, 40,000 Americans have signed the petition. The movement says the deal, known as the Project of Nimbus, would enable the apartheid Israeli regime to escalate surveillance of the Palestinians. Google and Amazon would provide Israel with cloud storage services and artificial intelligence tools under the contract. It was a case of morality and human concern. A Google employee quit the giant internet company Google over her views on censorship in Palestine. She believed that censoring news on Palestine through the cooperation of Google and Israel was an injustice to Palestinians. Her objection led to other Google employees quitting in protest. This was also a clear case of profiting off Israeli occupation.
The dirty espionage ties between giant tech company Google and the Israeli regime is back on the front burner. The story became headline after a Jewish worker of the company quit a post over Google's support for Israel. Ariel Koran is a marketing manager for Google's educational products and worked for the company for 7 years. She's written a memo to announce her resignation from the company over its support for Israel's crackdown against Palestinians. She has accused the company of retaliating against employees who spoke out in support of Palestine. She says Google has, quote, created an environment of fear for employees who support Palestine. Instead of listening to employees who want Google to live up to its ethical principles, Google is aggressively pursuing military contracts and stripping away the voices of its employees through a pattern of silencing and retaliation towards me and many others. She spent more than a year campaigning against the Project Nimbus with the Israeli military. She helped circulate petitions and talk to news organizations in a bid to pressure the company to reconsider the hefty project. But the company's response to her anti-Israel campaign was blunt and threatening. Relocate to Sao Paulo in Brazil within 17 business days or lose your job. 15 other Google employees have also raised their voices, urging the company to cut its business ties with Israel and review its treatment of Palestinians.
And the contract actually explicitly allows the Israeli government, including the Israeli military and the Israel Land Authority, to use the services however they would wish without the companies having any sort of right to regulate the way that the services are being used. And so as workers, in addition to having this kind of end goal that our companies will rescind these contracts, one of our goals is to emphasize that you can't enter into a business contract as a company that doesn't allow for the company itself to regulate the way that those services are being used. That is completely, it's unethical and it's dangerous, right? And as workers, one of the things that we're pushing for is our right to transparency. When we're putting our labor into building out services, how do those services get used? It's our right to understand that and to have transparency. And one of the things that frightens us about Project Nimbus specifically is that it almost feels that it's serving as a sort of testing ground for Google and Amazon's ability to fulfill military contracts where employees have no voice.
Ariel Koren, who herself is Jewish, has said that Google pressured her into resigning. She believed that the Project Nimbus would be used by Israel to commit human rights abuses against Palestinians. She said this would happen through the use of facial recognition and other machine learning surveillance and profiling tools.
Google's part in the controversial Nimbus project was unveiled in May 2021 as Israel was busy slaughtering Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The $1.2 billion project Nimbus, which is a partnership between Google, Amazon, and Israel, will provide the regime with a cloud computing system. The technology will give the Israeli military artificial intelligence technology and machine learning tools.
These contracts were signed the exact same week that we saw over 260 people in Gaza murdered at the hands of the Israeli military. And that to, you know, exactly the way Batul said it, it would have been really scary for us to see our technology being used in this way at any time. But the fact that this was the timing that was chosen doesn't seem like a coincidence to us. One other thing that I would add is the fact that the contracts themselves actually include a clause that explicitly basically disallows employee activism to actually lead to the contracts being rescinded. So the contracts in and of themselves protect against any sort of action from the companies to rescind the contracts in the event that employee activism emerges from the existence of these contracts.
The technology will allow Israel to increase its crackdown against Palestinians and further curtail the dwindling rights of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. It would also significantly enhance the surveillance of Palestinians and help expand Israel's illegal settlements on the occupied Palestinian lands.
Well, of course. I mean, Israel is not only silencing Palestinian voices. I mean, in truth, they're silencing Palestinian lives. I mean, every day we see videos out of Palestine with Israeli soldiers attacking children, arresting children, shutting down NGOs, destroying, you know, Palestinian houses, sometimes making Palestinians destroy their own houses. Of course, Israel has killed some Palestinian journalists. They are trying to silence the Palestinian people in a very profound way, and particularly those that are critical of Israel.
However, Google is not the only U.S. tech giant which is pro-Israel. Other platforms like Facebook and Instagram, which are owned by the same parent company Meta, have already been accused of removing posts displaying Israel's brutality against Palestinians, like bombardments of the neighborhoods in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli Air Force. The platforms have also been accused of censoring the voices of Palestinians raised against Israeli occupation.
Four Israeli troops have been wounded after they were attacked in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military says Palestinians hurled an improvised explosive device near a settlement in the northwest city of Ramallah. The military has launched a manhunt and reportedly closed off entrance to a nearby Palestinian village. The incident occurred hours after several Israeli soldiers were injured in a shooting attack on a bus elsewhere in the West Bank. Tensions are mounting across the occupied territories amid Israel's escalating raids and crackdown. Palestinians conduct retaliatory operations to avenge the regime's atrocities. Israel is set to approve the construction of two new settlements comprising more than 3,400 shelter units in the occupied West Bank over the next week. The Palestine Liberation Organization's Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission has disclosed the Israeli plan. It says the regime is considering new settlements on the eastern outskirts of the occupied city of Al-Quds. The head of the commission says some 2,000 Palestinians, including Bedouin communities, are at the risk of forced displacement, which amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements on the occupied territories are illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansions and called on the regime to put an end to such activities. Remote Canadian communities are shaken by a stabbing rampage. At least 10 people are killed and many more injured in multiple attacks in Saskatchewan province near the border with the United States.
At this point in our investigation, we have located 10 deceased individuals in 13 locations in the community of James Smith Cree Nation and Weldon, Saskatchewan.
Police say they have located the deceased individuals in 13 locations. They say 15 of those injured have so far been transferred to hospitals. Some of the victims are said to have been targeted, while others were randomly attacked. The suspects are still at large. The intention behind the stabbing attack is not yet known. The police have issued emergency alert all across Saskatchewan and adjoining Alberta and Manitoba provinces. A manhunt has been launched for two suspects. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the mass stabbing as, quote, horrific and heartbreaking. Thousands of mostly Russian-speaking anti-war protesters have marched through the western German city of Cologne, demanding Berlin stop supporting Ukraine. The demonstrators also called on the German government to drop sanctions it has imposed on Russia over its military operation against Ukraine. The rally, organized by Russian diaspora groups in the city, was met by a few dozen counter-protesters who had gathered to express support for Ukraine. The protest rallies come as Germany, like many other countries in Europe, is grappling with an energy crisis after Russia shut down its gas supplies to the continent. The German government has approved a 65 billion euro plan to ease pressure on households and businesses amid dwindling supplies and soaring energy bills. Iran's Kish airline has resumed flights to Afghanistan. Iranian and Afghan officials say this paves the way for closer economic cooperation between Iran and the conflict-stricken Afghanistan. Our correspondent reports from Kabul.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Mismanagement and drought conditions have affected roughly half of the landmass of the 48 contiguous U.S. states. What experts are asking these days is whether the U.S. could survive the mega drought that has gripped the country. Although the federal government has resorted to imposing significant cutbacks in water allocations to the seven states reliant on water from the drought-stricken Colorado River, there are possibilities that these tactics don't work. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The title of this article is Can U.S. agriculture survive mega drought? Stay with us, please. According to the website of Truthout, the federal government's recent announcement that it would impose significant cutbacks in water allocations to the seven states reliant on water from the drought-stricken Colorado River is the latest sign that climate change is ravaging global water systems. Arizona will lose more than 20% of its water allocation, and Nevada 8%. Northern Mexico, which is also reliant on the Colorado River and has been provided 1.5 million acre-feet of water per year from the river since a water-sharing treaty between the two countries was signed in 1944, is being hit hard as well, with a 7% reduction in its water allocation from the river. And 30 indigenous tribes, which have land in the Colorado Basin and which, as a result of a 1908 Supreme Court decision, have water rights from rivers running through their territories, are also preparing for a more arid future. Some are cutting back their water contributions to state reservoirs. Others, in a letter to the Department of the Interior, have noted that they aren't being adequately consulted on fundamental decisions regarding water usage and distribution in the region. And this is the mismanagement. In the American West, which scientists now believe is experiencing its worst drought in 1,200 years, tens of millions of people have migrated into the region since the federal water compacts around Colorado River water usage were signed a century ago. Even in non-drought years, the growing population routinely overdraws groundwater supplies, reducing stores of water that's accumulated over vast geological time spans. In the course of just four human generations, areas that once were simply desert have been converted into water-intensive global agribusiness hubs and into mega cities such as Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Las Vegas, ever more reliant on the waters from the Colorado River that are carefully stored in and distributed from Lake Mead and Lake Powell. Now, with these two vast reservoirs at only 28% of their capacity, many of those areas have to find ways to collectively reduce their water usage next year by between 2 and 4 million acre-feet, or a third of the annual flow of the river in an average year, which is what federal authorities believe is necessary to bring the river back to health. It's a staggering task. Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah, located in the upper basin of the river, are also facing large water supply deficits, though not nearly on the scale faced by their southern neighbors. So far, unlike Arizona and Nevada, they haven't faced mandatory cuts imposed by the federal government. California, being an older state, has more senior water rights than its neighbors to the east, and thus it is for now spared from cuts in its Colorado River allocations. That's a saving grace for Southern California, the sprawling cities of which receive roughly one-third of their water from the river. But relief is tempered by the fact that the state is facing its own devastating water shortages as a result of years of drought and declining snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Reservoirs such as Shasta Lake and Lake Orville are at or under 50% capacity. More than 500,000 acres of California farmland have been left fallow this year as farmers try to navigate shrinking water allotments from California's water supplies. The crisis of land use will only worsen next year, according to analysts. Drought conditions now affect roughly half of the landmass of 48 contiguous U.S. states. As a result, crops across the U.S. are under stress. The U.S. cotton crop this year could fall by 40%, but from Texas westward, the crisis is omnipresent. Farmers in the western states are reporting crop declines in fruits and tree nuts of up to 50%. Almond crops, which are extremely water-intensive, as well as rice and grapes, are at risk in California, where up to 800,000 acres of land could lie unused next year. Tomatoes, garlic, and other staples also aren't being planted in many California farms. And as with earlier droughts, livestock are being slaughtered in Texas, Oklahoma, and other drought-stricken states as owners struggle to pay for increasingly scarce feed and find enough water to keep the animals alive and healthy. All of this is pushing the world's food supply chains into crisis mode. We have gotten used to an abundance of industrially produced cheap food over the last 100 years. In other words, we complacently take it for granted that crises will be staggered rather than occurring simultaneously, that the fates will somehow be considerate in metering the food production challenges they send the way. But what if that assumption turns out to be wrong? What if a series of interconnected and accelerating climate crises around the world erupt simultaneously and rapidly take away the slack from the system? What if large areas of American West not only cease to be agriculturally productive, but also no longer have access to enough drinking water to sustain the tens of millions of people who now call the region home? The cuts to the Colorado River water allocations are unlikely to be simply a one-year blip. While this year's heavy monsoon in the Southwest has somewhat alleviated the drought, it will take years of abundant rainy seasons to make up for the deficits in water supply created by 22 years of drought and decades of caliber overdrawing of scarce reservoir water and groundwater supplies. In the meantime, the American West population continues to grow at unsustainable rates. The demands on its agricultural infrastructure keep expanding, and its insatiable thirst for water shows no sign of easing. If there is an exit from ramp to this particular highway, a method to avoid the pileup just ahead, it's unclear where it is or how it can be accessed. Water rights activists have long called for more equitable distribution of water, for more infrastructure to secure drinking water in poor rural communities in particular, and for a move away from the most water-intensive crops and most water-wasteful practices in areas with dwindling groundwater supplies. Now, as the global water and food crisis intensifies, these issues are acquiring critical importance on social justice campaigns, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us ponder upon a beautiful statement from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Beware of the flight of blessings, for nothing that runs away is returned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, community environment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of community environment in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic studies and Islamic teachings, we see that community is a part of personal life and it is not separate from the personal life. Generally, we see that people pay attention to their personal life and they do not pay attention towards the community life or the social life or the society. And therefore, there are many things that are happening in the society, and we are ignorant towards that. Especially living in the West, we have seen that if a crime is happening in the society, if in a place or a street some crime has happened, people generally try to avoid such things. They do not become witness. Why? Because it might bring some consequences for them. It might bring some kind of hardship in their life, or they might face some troubles in future. Therefore, they avoid all these things. And therefore, this avoiding the crime or avoiding the corruption that is happening in the society results in more corruption and in more crime. And God forbids us from such thing that sometime it might happen to us that we get involved and the same thing is happening with us as well. And there is no one else to help us. Therefore, Islam says that the community environment should be clean. And it can be clean only when you are paying attention towards the community, when you are attentive to the community, and when you are looking after of what is happening around you in your surroundings. And we all are answerable to what is happening in our surroundings. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of community environment in the Islamic lifestyle and its importance. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in one of his narrations, he quotes the narration of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He says that the Prophet has said, "Inna al-ma'i ma'asiyata." Certainly, the sin, إِذَا عَمِلَ بِهَا الْعَبْدُ سِرًّا, if a person has committed that sin in a hidden, or he has done it privately, no one knows about it, لَمْ تَذُرَّ إِلَّا عَمِلَهَا, it does not harm except the one who has performed it. وَإِذَا عَمِلَ بِهَا عَلَانِيَةً, and if he has performed it apparently in front of others in the community, then وَلَمْ يُغَيِّرْ عَلَيْهِ أَضَرَّةِ الْعَامَّ, and nothing will change him, nothing will bring a change to him, but except there is a harm to the public, there is a harm to the society, and it is necessary. You know, generally we see that there is, even if a small group of people, they commit sin, and if we are silent on it, if we do not raise our voice against that sin, against that corruption, against that injustice, then obviously it will slowly spread in the community. People will get habitual in seeing the sins committed by individuals in the society. For example, in the month of Ramadan, we see there are many people now that they do not fast. Initially, there were like few of them, but now we see that the number of people are growing. Why? Because when we do not raise our voice against such things, if they are not fasting, they should not show it off in the community. They should stay at home and hide the matter that they're not fasting. But when it becomes apparent in the society, the people, when they're not talking against it, it becomes something regular or something which is been happening for the times, and people start doing that, and the sins spreads and the corruption spreads in the society. Therefore, we must avoid such things, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agriculture University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood-affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows to the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing taste and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones, which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture. These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and a broad Nineveh province that includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month. The floating cinema of unknown waters is back in the Italian city of Venice and spectators are getting buoyant to reach the annual Open Sea Film Festival. On board a rowing boat, a motorboat, gondolas and whatever capable of floating, spectators sail to the shallows behind the Giudecca Island for this one-of-a-kind cinematic experience. The audience can watch the program from their own boat or a barge with chairs for those without floating transportation. The event consists of a series of screenings, performances and presentations on a floating platform and is held for 12 nights in the Venetian Lagoon.
A new bird species has been discovered on the southernmost islands of the Americas. Biologists are baffled.
Discovering new bird species is very, very difficult and rare because the world has been more focused on observing birds. Therefore, this means the discovery site is unique in the sub-Antarctic zone, on which Chile has important sovereignty. This raises the importance of caring for the environment and unique ecosystems, as these sites will allow us to carry out research on climate change, new species and behaviors.
The tiny bird weighs only 16 grams and has a large beak with black and yellow streaks along its body. Researchers say the animal is a subcategory of a species typically found in the Patagonia forest and inhabits tree trunks. But the newly discovered cousin has surprised scientists as it learned to burrow and live in a harsh tundra climate with bitter temperatures. The Diego Ramirez archipelago, where the bird was found, is an isolated bit of land. It also lacks mammalian predators and woody plants. Biologists and researchers from Chilean universities and various academic centers studied the birds for 6 years before announcing the new species.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The next moonshot is finally getting closer. NASA says it's ready to test its next-generation rocket ship on an epic launch set for August the 29th as part of its mission to send people to the moon.
This new deep space exploration system is going to take us back to the moon and to new science discoveries that we can't even imagine yet. NASA is about to make history with this first flight of the Artemis program.
The mega rocket combines the Space Launch System, or SLS, and the Orion crew capsule it will carry to space. The rocket is due to blast off for a test drive from the U.S. base Kennedy Space Center, sending an empty crew capsule around the moon and back to the Earth. The Artemis 1 test flight is planned to take 6 weeks. It's meant to rigorously stress the systems to determine whether the vehicle is ready to safely carry astronauts. The program aims to establish a long-term lunar colony as a stepping stone to the even more ambitious future voyages that will send people to Mars. The SLS represents the biggest new vertical launch system NASA has built since those flown in the 1960s and 70s. This story will tell you about what could be the bright side of climate change, and that's the discovery of dinosaur tracks dating back to 113 million years ago. The tracks were found in the U.S. state of Texas, where drought has dried up parts of Palaxy River. Experts say the tracks belong to a two-legged dinosaur with small arms and weighing 7 tons. They say dinosaurs made the prints as they roamed muddy areas over 100 million years ago. The prints were then covered over with sediment due to a flood. And after that, they turned into limestone, protecting the prints. The experts say the tracks have not been seen either before or in decades. Age does not matter, it's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps the trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper. evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. An inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet, powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the red planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space-age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant to for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth. Japanese plastic food artisans are showcasing their mouth-watering artificial creations at an exhibition in Japan's capital city, Tokyo. From the Leaning Tower of Pizza to fish slicing and cooking, or even the quirky stacked pancakes, you can find almost everything at the exhibit. Other sculptors, including a deep-fried shrimp with four breaded legs scaling a mountain of shredded cabbage like a tiger. Another creation on display is a Tetris game made of chicken. Plastic food artists get really excited for the exhibition each year as they are given a chance to practice their own spin on creativity, bringing food to life with curious characters.
So normally we have to follow orders from clients. We take their views on board when we're making items. Normally that's our work. But for the competition, you can use your imagination. How it finally ends up is totally up to you. I like that aspect of it.
There are some 60 sculptors on display. Some are silly, but others highlight the artist's skills. The models were made with the same careful detail as the rock-solid noodle soups and crispy-looking plastic snacks on display outside Japanese restaurants. There is a lucrative business for them in Japan.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and stealing their land since its inception. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Gaza on Screen: How Palestinian Truth Implicates All of Humanity. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Telling you the truth, the Israeli regime, military or propaganda, from which major U.S. and European media outlets, including the BBC and New York Times, take their cues, or countless Palestinian filmmakers transforming the facts of their experiences into artistic truth. Where do sublime works of art stand vis-a-vis the relentless barrage of falsehoods and propaganda that conquerors habitually spin to justify and camouflage their barbarians? What is a Ghassan Kanafani novella, a Mona Hatoum artwork, a Mahmoud Darwish poem, or an Ilya Soleiman film next to Israeli regime tanks, fighter jets, smart bombs, assassination squads, nuclear submarines, or sharpshooters? When an empire is vast and variegated like the U.S., it can afford both military thuggery around the globe and ingenious filmmakers such as Stanley Kubrick, Oliver Stone, or the Hugh brothers to dismantle the lies of those conquests. When a settler colony like the fabricated regime of Israel is too small to afford such complexities, it just bombs, maims, and murders, while its propaganda machinery does the camouflaging in manipulated news coverage. In the Palestinian case, there is no military to speak of. What they have on their side are facts and truth, truth that would have gone unheard were it not for the Palestinian poets, journalists, scholars, artists, novelists, and filmmakers. But isn't this comparing apples and oranges? The military might of a settler colony to the works of art that those under its occupation produce? But that amounts to asymmetrical warfare. Palestinians have no military, air force, or navy. The Zionists do. Palestinians do not receive billions of dollars in military aid from the U.S. and Europe. The Zionists do. Palestinians wage only a form of guerrilla warfare imposed on them by cruel fate. Militarily, Palestine is no match for the fake regime of Israel, but artistically, aesthetically, morally, and imaginatively, the Zionist regime is no match for Palestine. Take the most recent Zionist regime atrocities in Gaza earlier this month. A relentless blockade and repeated invasions of the Gaza Strip culminated in yet another war of aggression that terrorized Palestinians, destroyed their homes, and denied them their livelihoods. what is the function of Palestinian filmmakers in times of such Israeli